WNYC is supported by the World Class Learning Academy, an international private school dedicated to instilling in children the skills and knowledge to succeed. Located in the East Village, applications for 2 to 10-year-olds are being accepted for September. More info at wclacademy.org.
Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
How got over? My soul looks back in life. How got over? Gonna thank him for what he's done for me.
What do Marianne Williams, Aretha Franklin, Thomas Mann, and gay gospel singers of the Pentecostal Church have in common? They're all subjects of Anthony Hobbit's collection of essays called The Fan Who Knew Too Much, Aretha Franklin, The Rise of the Soap Opera, Children of the Gospel Church, and Other Meditations. One reviewer called it a brilliant, one-of-a-kind, and immensely challenging book by a brilliant, one-of-a-kind American writer. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased to welcome Tony Hobbit back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Now, your previous books have been a history of gospel music, a book about German emigres in the United States, and a book about Thomas Mann. Are these essays a continuation of your thinking about those subjects in the years since the books were published?
Absolutely, but with many new conclusions and a lot of new information.
Well, you also write about some other matters like soap operas, blues history, male sopranos, mm-hmm. and the nature of fandom. In the case of gospel music, are there issues here that you couldn't have written about in the early 70s?
Absolutely. When I wrote The Gospel Sound, which came out in 71, and wonderfully is still in print after over 40 years, I had a very short section in which I dealt with the significance of lesbian and gay engagement in gospel music, maybe two or three sentences. And they became quite notorious. In fact, I was once told that my book had become the most stolen book in the Chicago library system. But I didn't go any further simply because it was too radioactive at the time.
Well, some people were objecting.
Indeed,
absolutely. Did others nod their head and say, well, he got it right? He's telling the real story?
Everyone knew I had gotten it right, but I was told that preachers all over the country were up in arms against this New Yorker.
But you also say that gays and lesbians were the rock and the shield of the black church. So the ministers couldn't have been surprised.
They all knew. They all knew, and especially and dependent on them. And Leonard, because I'm interested in history, I was thinking that the parallel that and it may seem extremely dramatic is, do you remember how Stalin would write out people, and every few years there'd be a new photo of the major Bolsheviks, and it wound up being a trio or a duo or pretty much a Stalin himself. And I think to rewrite gays and lesbians out of the history of gospel music, or for the matter, out of history of civil rights, and the two are so intimately linked, is just as ahistorical and just as specious.
Well, this book is not only about that, but let's address it a bit more. You go into great detail on the subject in your first essay, The Children and Their Secret Closet. Is children a word used to describe gay people in the church?
Yes, there was a double pun there, which I tried to translate very quickly. But the code name within the church for gay people would be the children, which is a whole lot nicer than some of the more derogatory terms which are still very wide, very widespread, like sissies and bulldaggers. But children is much more polite. And secret closet is a very common religious term. It comes out of the scripture, and it refers to a special unit where one can commune with the spirit. And, of course, the pun on closet was irresistible.
You say that the history of Pentecostalism is linked to the history of gays in America.
Thank you for bringing that up, because most of the reviews have focused on my treatment of the black church. And because I've worked so much with black gospel music and with my first book on the subject, I can understand that. But I did a lot of research and discovered a lot of new material new for me, about the role of gays within the white Pentecostal church. And it's extensive, starting with the man who brought in the whole phenomenon of speaking in tongues, a man named Charles Fox Parham, who brought in that particular practice in around 1900, and a few years later would be accused of messing with young boys, something we've heard about in recent years.
Now, why Pentecostal church? You don't hear much about this in, all churches, in fact, every community in the world.
We know that now. I used to,
it's not the same within the Baptist church or the Methodist church.
Oh, sure it is. Sure it is. It's just, in fact, one interviewer asked me a few weeks ago, he said, well, this is true of the small churches and the sanctified, but it's certainly not true of the Baptists. I said, absolutely, absolutely. It's just that because the Pentecostal churches were so emotive and expressive, and because they were newcomers, and most particularly because they were a congregation of poor people, as I like to say, these were the churches of little ships, not the big ships. They left themselves very open, and people would condemn them for many reasons.
Now, I'm probably the wrong person to ask this question, but why gospel music for you, of all the musical forms that were available to you when you were young?
Well, we're roughly the same generation, and you may remember when we were young, there was a guy on the radio called Alan Freed. And I was an early fan of rock and roll when Alan Freed was still calling himself Moondog. I had extremely tolerant parents. They were refugees from Hitler, and they had a great respect for African-American culture. So when I started going to the Apollo Theater when I was 13 or 14, they didn't stop me. And I almost always went by myself, and the ushers, I guess, took pity on this lone kid from Forest Hills, and they said, boy, you think this is good. You haven't seen nothing till you hear our gospel. And were they right? I started attending the gospel shows, and they were so very much better. So very much. It's not a little thing. It was a huge difference, and then I got hooked.
Well, if you like doo-wop, and then you saw some of the great gospel quartets of the time, you realize that it was a difference between kids doing the music and professionals singing the music.
Sure. And in 1954, 55, 56, when I was 14 or so, the big stars were people like Little Richard and all the people who came out of Little Richard, like Otis Redding and James Brown and the Isley Brothers, etc. And they all admitted that their inspiration was the woman you started playing, Marion Williams, who was then the lead singer of the famous Ward Singers. Aretha Franklin came up a couple years later, 59-60. Her inspiration was Clara Ward, the lead singer of the Ward Singers. Sam Cooke was everybody's favorite soul singer in the late 50s, and he'd switched almost overnight from the famous quartet, the Soul Stirrers.
Then there was Lou Rawls and
The first gospel show I ever attended at the Apollo Theater, I've been going to the R&B shows for a couple years before, it was 57, and Lou Rawls was a quartet called the Pilgrim Travelers. He was fine, but the one who blew me away was a fellow named Jess Whitaker. And anyone who's ever heard Ray Charles and then hears Jess Whitaker will know that Jess is the source.
Getting back to the gays in the church, you say that pretty much all of the choir leaders, many of the soloists in most of the small churches were likely to be gay.
Well, I don't want to go that far, but many, certainly among the influential singers, soloists, group directors, choir directors, composers, musicians, the percentage is very high.
Well, including one of the most famous of all, James Cleveland.
Who died of AIDS and was for many years the king of gospel, maybe 30 years, and was and not merely was influential as an artist, but had an institutional impact when he conceived or initiated, actually was conceived by Alex Bradford, he conceived the Gospel Music Workshop of America, which is the major organization of its kind.
Now, were the ministers more likely to look the other way before the AIDS epidemic? Did that change things?
When I was a kid, I saw and I didn't see. So I certainly did see the ministers being very friendly with the singers and socializing it. But I know that it was sometime in the 80s when AIDS first reared its hideous head that I started hearing these preachers making these hateful comments that AIDS was God's punishment. And some of these pastors were men whom I knew were gay. And I even confronted a couple, and they were kind of sheepish about it, and said on one hand they hoped they didn't get caught. On the other hand, they said God was angry. And so they were sort of spinning on a dime.
Well, this, of course, was not just in the black church. We saw Ted Haggard, for example, go through something similar. There have been any number of clergy.
Leonard, that's a big surprise
to me.
And
we're seeing it now and also within the Hasidic community in Brooklyn.
Sure. Well, sometimes I have said rather impiously that I consider the Hasidim as Jewish Pentecostals. Their behavior are rather similar. But that's a whole other story. I discovered, again, this was all new research for me. I knew the black gospel world quite well, I'd say. But I discovered major figures, important positions have been outed in recent years. For example, there's a very important new neo-Pentecostal charismatic church called the Vineyard Movement. And that's the church where Bob Dylan was briefly saved and sanctified. One of their major pastors, a man who has spoken of visions of going to heaven, recently confessed that he was both gay and an alcoholic, which was rather late in the day considering he was 75.
Also has an odd name, doesn't he?
I forget his name.
Frisbee?
No. That's a very poignant character. Some of your listeners may remember in the 60s and 70s when a lot of these working-class hippies became Jesus freaks. And the major Jesus freak, the most important, was a guy with the beautiful name Lonnie Frisbee. And Lonnie died a few years ago, by that time totally abandoned by everyone in the church.
There might not be an obvious connection between gospel music and Thomas Mann, but Tony Heilbutt talks about both in his new book, The Fan Who Knew Too Much, Aretha Franklin, The Rise of the Soap Opera, Children of the Gospel Church, and Other Meditations. It's published by Knopp. There's a long piece here on Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul. What are the links between gospel music and soul music?
Well, there are some people who will say just the nouns have changed, that virtually all the significant soul singers came out of gospel. Very, very few exceptions. The very amiable Betty LeVette is one. She's an exception. She said Jesus had nothing to do with her career. I find that rather charming. But most of the major singers, I've called a few names already, Little Richard, Sam Cooke, Aretha, et cetera, et cetera. What I did with Aretha, Leonard, is we've read so many tributes to the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen as major cultural actors. And I know that they've had huge impacts on their fans. But I thought that Aretha's impact is more considerable. In fact, I'm bold enough to say you can divide African-American history into pre- and post-Aretha.
In what way?
Well, before Aretha sort of synthesized gospel and R&B, blues, jazz, and
Well, she wasn't the first to do that. You had Dinah Washington before her.
And I write about Dinah. But within her generation, she did it more boldly. And actually, she did it in some ways more boldly than Dinah was more cunning with it. Aretha made it very clear to the extent that I have seen Aretha sing what remains, was both her first and probably remains her deepest blues. Yesterday I sang a love song, today I sing the blues, or I've seen her do I Never Loved a Man. And women fell out, started screaming as if it were a church service.
Her father was the Reverend C.L. Franklin, a famous civil rights activist and a major recording artist in his own right.
And a very great singer.
So was he an influence on her?
Huge, a huge influence. And
she said he was the greatest man I know.
Yes, yeah. And a fascinating character. I spent a lot of time on him because he was so verbally skilled. He was a man who managed to avoid what's called Ebonics, and yet he was absolutely thrilling within a folkloric style.
And you say that because he sang so clearly, enunciated so well, he influenced his daughter, and that was one of the reasons that she could appeal to white audiences as well.
Thank you, because that was one of a little point that I made. I think that was even picked up in the Wall Street Journal, that while singers like Mahalia Jackson had what Mahalia called her New Orleans brogue, and sometimes the words went very clear, and very frequently she would drop a final S. Aretha loves the letter S. And I say, if you pay close attention, especially to early records, you wait for it. It's almost erotic the way she is.
You also include essays about German emigres, soap operas, male sopranos. What's the connection between all these people other than they're of interest to you?
They're all fans who knew too much and paid for it. You know, I mean, maybe the most obvious example is male sopranos who defy nature with sounds that many people find absolutely grotesque.
Did that grow out of your interest in gospel music?
Yes.
Because there are men in gospel who do sound like women. And you point out in one case there was a woman who sang with male groups, but nobody knew that she was a woman.
Yeah, well, that was a singer with the beautifully chosen name Little Axe. And when it was after Little Axe's death, it was determined Little Axe was not a male tenor. And I once joked that gospel was the music of male sopranos and female basses. But just as we were naive, you mentioned earlier, we were naive to think that this was only true of the poor churches, what I said earlier. I would imagine it might be in the Unitarian Church. I don't think demographics will change that much. But so I was naive enough to think that nobody but gospel singers would be brave enough or bold enough to try to sing F above soprano high C. Well, I was wrong. And in fact, the magazine The Believer has just serialized my essay in the male soprano. And to my surprise, these very young people seem to be intrigued by the phenomenon.
You you wrote a book about the impact of the German emigres on America and our impact on them. And you follow up, and then another book on Thomas Mann. And you have a chapter here called Somebody Else's Paradise, in which you deal with Mann and Einstein and others. What kind of impact did America have on Thomas Mann? Well, he wrote two of his greatest works after he came here, didn't he?
Well, what I stress, and I did this here, I'm particularly stressed, but I mentioned in the last book, Thomas Mann, Erison, and Literature, is that Mann, who we're pretty clear, despite his six children, was a gay man, even if he may never even done the deed. He was fully aware of this. He loved American homosexuality. And during the 1920s, when he was in Germany and he was trying to ward off the threat of Nazism, and he was trying to sell American democracy to the German students, and he used Walt Whitman. And in 1950, when he was really brokenhearted, his son had committed suicide, his books had stopped selling, everything was working against him. In fact, he had such a good sense of the American public, talk about fans who knew too much, that when Harry Levin changed his famous course at Harvard, Proust, Joyce, and Mann to Proust, Joyce, and Kafka, Thomas Mann saw the lighting on the handwriting on the wall. But then he reads Gore Vidal, The City and the Pillar, and that has a transformative experience effect
well,
on
but,
him.
But he had written a major work of gay literature, even though many people saw it as metaphorical, when he wrote Death in Venice.
Sure, sure. But City and the Pillar is a whole lot bolder. And at that time, another American writer named Donald Wintem sent him some stories he had written, and Mann wrote him a very grand magisterial letter. Thank you for your serenely, composed story. And I joked, it reads like it was composed by Dennis Cooper. In other words, it's hardcore porn.
We have a caller, Derek from Manhattan, who wants to talk about the gospel groups of the past. Hi, Derek.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I try to listen to you every day. I was curious if your guest has any recollection of the Southern Sons gospel group, I believe, out of Augusta, Georgia, in the late or mid to late 50s. The lead singer was James Brown before he went to popular music.
I don't know. I know that James Walker of the Dixie Hummingbirds sang with the Southern Sons, and so did Jimmy Jones, who later on went to the Harmonizing Four. The really famous Southern Sons were a quartet from the early 40s who came out of the Golden Gate and terrific Jubilee Quartet. I didn't know that James Brown. I didn't know that. I never knew that James sang with a quartet. I know that he was very loyal to the Swanee Quintet and
yes.
even used them on, he even recorded them on King.
Yes, he was. I wish my father was on the line to talk to you. My father is the lead guitarist for the sensational Pearly Gates.
And I remember them.
Really?
Yeah.
Outstanding. I'm going to send this, tell my father to tune in this this recording. But when I was a child, 2 to 3 years old, my father made my brother and I give up our bed for this guy who was had a engagement with the Pearly Gates. And when I was about 8 or 9, my father reminded me about that situation. He said, "Dad, that guy was James Brown, because we were all going crazy over the new pop songs."
Well, that could be, because people did go in and out of gospel, although a listener wonders about Ray Charles. Ray Charles never really sang
gospel.
No, and
in fact, I make a very big point. Ray Charles cannot be compared to Aretha, because Aretha exhibits what I call spirit feel, which means every time a good gospel singer is up, they're going to sing differently. And Ray Charles' orchestra, his band, said he was a stickler for perfection. You did not ad lib. Those arrangements were worked out. He didn't come out of gospel. His idols were Charles Brown and Nat King Cole. It's just that in the early mid-50s, he got smitten with the gospel sound, And he started adapting gospel songs.
Now, much of this book is about the outsider mentality, but how does that apply to your essay on soap operas? Does that come out of the emigre, the thing about emigres in America?
No, here's something. It was very funny to see that the major soap opera figure was a woman named Erna Phillips, who was a Chicago Jewish woman who started, who made her debut for virtually the first famous daytime serial, Today's Children, in which she played Mother Moran, although her relative says she sounded Hungarian and not Irish. Well, Erna is the one who created everything we think of as soap opera, somebody having a baby by what she thinks is her husband, but it's really her brother-in-law, or her husband
having amnesia.
All of that, and people having babies after people, after their mates die, and then saying that their second husband is really the father of the baby. All of this. Erna was I call it the daytime serial's unwed mother. She never married. She was, in her own words, a dull wallflower and an ugly duckling.
Well, the soap operas remain popular for about 70 years, but they've kind of lost their popularity in recent years, although not in other countries. We have the telenovelas in many countries, soap operas in Russia, Asia, elsewhere.
And actually, so much of what's still popular, like reality television, is pretty much soap opera all over again. And people are so smitten with serials. All of that kind of devotion to storytelling can be ascribed to radio pioneers like Erna Phillips. Erna, though, was so interesting to me because she was very much the fan who knew too much. By the end of her life, she was so hated that when she sold Another World and As the World Turns, on the Guiding Light, really very big creations, her brother, the postman, had to negotiate for her. And by the end of the life, she was thinking of becoming a sales lady at Marshall Field.
Now, we have very little time, but I want to address the title of the book and the title essay, The Fan Who Knew Too Much, about the nature of fandom. Do you consider yourself a typical fan?
Maybe not typical, but ultimately, everything sort of devolves on me, I guess. And so finally, it is a journal of a certain sensibility.
Well, you're right, that one area where people find it difficult to countenance disagreement is when you don't share their tastes. You can have a perfectly pleasant dinner with people whose politics are different and all that, but if you tell a Dylan fan you don't like the way he sings, you can be sure it's going to be a very unpleasant evening.
I've heard a lot of people that way, and in turn, people have offended me when they didn't care for my artists. So I understand this. In fact, I say this seems to be a new phenomenon, which maybe we can date back to the early 20th century.
Not the love of someone like Liszt, who had loyal fans?
But you didn't think you were going to be Liszt. You didn't play air piano. You didn't play or air guitar. And you might think that Liszt could develop. When you heard Liszt perform and he no longer had his chops, you weren't filling in all the spaces. I just read that people attended Roger Waters. He's around my age, 68 years old. There's no way he's going to be whatever kind of rock stud star he was when he was in his mid-20s. But the audience would perceive him that way. I took, for example, I do a parallel in sports among sports fans. When Muhammad Ali sickened, people were taking it as this was something personal, as if their bodies had collapsed. And this sort of very intimate involvement with one's heroes, I think, is something new.
Well, following the sports thing a bit more, a player starts losing his reflexes, let's say a great hitter, when he hits a certain age, and then retires and goes into some other thing. Whereas we have the Rolling Stones at the age of late 60s, early 70s, still contemplating another tour.
And it's a hit record. A hit record, something about my Jagger moves. I was very fortunate. Most fans of other of sports,
but that's
for example,
5, isn't it?
What?
Jagger moves. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, Adam Levine, I think, is the singer. Anyway, but I can't tell you much more than that. But I had a chance to work with some of my favorite artists. You mentioned Marion Williams, but also with so many others: Claude Jeter, R.H. Harris, Ines Andrews, Dario Philip Coates, et cetera, et cetera. What a thrill for someone to work with one's heroes so late in the day.
Well, you mentioned Aretha Franklin as being a key figure in American culture. Let's go out with a little from Aretha Franklin. Thank you so much, Anthony Hobbit. The book, The Fan Who Knew Too Much, Aretha Franklin, The Rise of the Soap Opera, Children of the Gospel Church, and Other Meditations. It's published by Knopp.
There's water.
Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.